Ever feel like you want to, really get a grip on some of those big important topics out there, but without drowning in all the details?
Oh, absolutely. Especially when it comes to these kind of complex legal cases that have a real impact, shaping the world around us, so to speak.
Right. So today we're taking a deep dive into Boulder v. Early, kind of like your express lane, to understanding this pivotal case about holding the government accountable, and all tied in with environmental justice, all stemming from the Flint water crisis, without having to wade through mountains of legal jargon.
Exactly. Boulder v. Early, decided by the Sixth Circuit back in 2017, it's a landmark case for sure. It really makes you think, when those in power, when their actions put public health in jeopardy, who's ultimately responsible? And what tools, what legal avenues do people have, the communities affected, to seek justice? We've gone ahead and distilled, pulled out the key insights from a really detailed analysis of the case, a standard legal brief, and of course, all our prep for this deep dive.
Great. So the goal is to give everyone listening a crystal clear picture of this case and why it still matters so much today.
That's it. That's the mission.
So let's kick things off by setting the stage. The Flint water crisis itself. Anyone needing a refresher? Back in 2014, Flint made a pretty big move.
Absolutely. Trying to save some money, the city decided to switch its water source. They ditched the Detroit system, which gets its water from Lake Huron, and opted for the Flint River instead.
Sounds
Yeah.
straightforward enough, right?
Yeah.
Just a budget decision. But there was a pretty big misstep along the way, wasn't there?
Yeah, a critical one. They skipped a really vital step, adding something called corrosion control treatment to the water.
Corrosion control. Why was that such a huge oversight?
See, the Flint River water, it's more corrosive, and without that treatment, it started eating away at the city's pipes, a lot of which were, pretty old, made of lead. And so lead started leaching into the water, contaminating the drinking water supply. And pretty much right away, residents started noticing problems. The water had this weird color and it smelled off.
Yeah, I can only imagine turning on the tap and seeing, something's clearly wrong. But it wasn't just about how it looked or smelled, was it?
No, not at all. Tests were done and they found really high, alarmingly high levels of lead in the water, along with other nasty stuff, bacteria, things like that. And then there was that terrible outbreak of Legionnaire's disease, and it was traced back to the contaminated water.
And it's just unbelievable they were still getting bills for this dangerous water. I even read that some people were penalized for not paying. Hard to wrap your head around that.
It really is. And you can't just ignore what the Michigan Civil Rights Commission found. They concluded that systemic racism actually played a role, a significant role in this whole crisis. You have to remember, Flint's population is largely Black and low income, and that fact is inseparable from how poorly the situation was handled and, of course, all the harm that was caused.
And let's not forget about those state-appointed emergency managers. They were the ones calling the shots, right?
Right.
They had a lot of power at that time.
Right. Michigan law, it allows for these managers to be appointed to oversee local governments that are struggling financially. And initially, they really downplayed the whole water situation, even as the evidence of contamination just kept mounting. And eventually, Flint did switch back to the Detroit water system, but the damage was already done. The lead contamination, it didn't go away because of those pipes, they were just too corroded.
So with all that in mind, with this huge public health failure, it's no surprise that, that legal action followed. Where did they first file their lawsuit?
They went to federal court, filing under a really important law, Title 42 of the U.S. Code, Section 1983. Most people just call it Section 1983. And basically, this law lets individuals sue state and local officials when they believe those officials have violated their constitutional rights. And in this case, the residents argued that their right to bodily integrity, protected by the 14th Amendment, had been violated, as well as their right to equal protection under the law.
So what did the district court, what did they have to say about that?
Well, the district court dismissed the case, and they did that based on the idea of preemption. They argued that because we already have the Safe Drinking Water Act, or SDWA, a law specifically to regulate water quality, it basically blocked the constitutional claims being brought under Section 1983.
Okay, preemption. So the district court thought that because there's a specific law for water quality, the residents couldn't make these broader constitutional arguments.
That's the gist of it. Yeah. It's like when a really specific law, it kind of overrides a more general one when they both cover the same thing. The court felt the SDWA very specific kind of trumped the more general constitutional arguments. But then the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, they stepped in and reversed that decision. They said, hold on, we got to figure out two really important things here. First, did the SDWA actually prevent the residents from using Section 1983? And second, could the court actually issue orders to those state officials, you know, what they call injunctive relief, even with the idea of sovereign immunity, which usually protects states from some lawsuits?
So the Sixth Circuit disagreed with the lower court. Why did they think the constitutional claims could move forward, even with the SDWA already in place?
It all comes down to preemption, really. They used what's called the Fitzgerald test, which gives guidelines for figuring out when a federal law might, you know, kind of override other claims. So they looked at the SDWA, like really dug into the actual text, and they couldn't find anything saying Congress wanted to stop people from using Section 1983.
That makes sense. If Congress wanted to block something that fundamental, you'd think they would have said so clearly, right? What else did the court look at?
They also compared the SDWA and Section 1983. But in terms of the remedies they provide, the SDWA, its main focus is setting standards for water. And, you know, it allows for actions like injunctions to make sure those standards are met. But Section 1983, it offers a much wider range of options, including monetary damages, which can compensate people for the harm they've suffered. That difference, it made the court think, okay, maybe Section 1983 is meant to address things that the SDWA doesn't fully cover, you know, fill in the gaps.
So one's about setting the rules, and the other is more about, holding people accountable when those rules lead to violations of basic rights and, maybe even providing some compensation for those who were hurt.
Exactly. Now, the third part of this Fitzgerald test is about looking at what rights and protections each law provides. So the SDWA, it regulates specific contaminants, right? It says this much of this, that much of that. You can't have too much of this thing in the water. But the Constitution, especially that 14th Amendment, it's about broader rights, bodily integrity, equal protection under the law. The court, they realized these aren't the same thing. They have different purposes. And that further convinced them that the SDWA shouldn't automatically block those constitutional claims. It's like the SDWA sets the minimum, you know, the floor, but it doesn't stop people from seeking additional protections when their fundamental rights are violated.
Okay, that makes the whole preemption issue much clearer. But what about sovereign immunity? That idea that states and state officials have some level of protection from being sued?
Yeah, that's where the 11th Amendment comes in. It's part of the Constitution, and it usually stops states from being sued in federal court for money damages, unless they say it's okay. But there's this really important exception called the Ex parte Young Doctrine, and that exception, it lets people file lawsuits seeking injunctions, which are like orders from the court telling state officials to stop doing something that violates federal law. They can sue those officials in their official capacity.
So in this Biller case, were the residents mainly looking for money from the state, or were they trying to get the state to fix the problem, make them take action?
They wanted action. That's what they were after. And the Sixth Circuit, they saw that the lead pipes in Flint, that was an ongoing violation of federal law. And because of that, because it was ongoing, they said, okay, under that Ex parte Young Doctrine, the residents can try to get a court order telling the state to fix it. Replace those pipes, do what needs to be done. The key takeaway is states have some protection, yeah, but they can't just hide behind it when they're actively violating people's rights, especially when the goal is to stop that violation from continuing.
That's an important difference to understand. Now, we talked about the specific constitutional claims, due process and equal protection. Can you give us a little more detail on how the Sixth Circuit saw those in this case?
Sure. The due process claim, that was about bodily integrity. The court talked about this thing called the special danger doctrine. It comes into play when the government, they create a dangerous situation, and then, knowing it's dangerous, they basically just ignore it, act with deliberate indifference, as they say. And the residents, their argument was that those officials, by switching to the Flint River and not treating the water, they created this danger, and then they just ignored it, even when it was clear how bad the lead contamination was. It's like, you know, if the government dug a huge hole in the road and just left it there, even with people warning them someone's going to fall in.
Gotcha. And the equal protection claim, that's where the discrimination comes in, right? Based on race and income.
Yeah. The residents said they were discriminated against because of both their race and their economic situation. Most people in Flint are minorities and low income, and they were the ones exposed to the lead, while wealthier, mostly white areas were still getting safe water. The Sixth Circuit specifically mentioned what the Michigan Civil Rights Commission found, which showed just how much systemic inequality played a role in all of this.
It feels like this case has implications that go beyond just what happened in Flint, you know? What's the big takeaway, the thing our listeners should really understand about this ruling?
I think the big thing is it shows us that even when you have specific laws like the Safe Drinking Water Act, that doesn't mean the Constitution goes out the window. Your basic rights, those still matter. If those rights are violated, you have Section 1983, which gives you a way to seek justice through the courts. The water law, it's mostly about fixing the system and setting those standards. Section 1983 is about making sure people who are harmed because their rights were violated, they have some recourse, some way to be made whole.
So just because we have regulations doesn't mean the Constitution becomes irrelevant.
Exactly. And Bowler v. Early, it shines a spotlight on how important environmental justice is. It shows how, you know, when environmental dangers disproportionately affect minority communities or poor communities, that can actually be a basis for a legal claim, an equal protection claim.
And it reminds us that sovereign immunity that protection states have, it's not a get-out-of-jail-free card.
Right. It doesn't mean you can just ignore people's rights and then say, oh, well, you can't sue me, especially when the harm is still happening and people are trying to stop it.
So the government, they have this duty to protect people, to keep them safe. And when they don't do that, when they violate people's basic rights in the process, especially the rights of vulnerable populations, they can be held accountable.
That's right. It's about accountability at the end of the day.
So to wrap up our deep dive into Bowler v. Early, it really shows us how powerful constitutional law is. It can force the government to answer for its actions, especially when those actions lead to public health crises and disproportionately harm marginalized communities. Even when you have specific laws already in place, the Constitution is still there as a safeguard.
A great summary, I'd say. It really drives home the idea that the Constitution is still a powerful tool to ensure that everyone is protected equally and that those in power are held responsible for what they do.
And that brings us to something for you all to think about, you know, as you move forward. We still see so many challenges, right? Communities dealing with aging infrastructure, potential environmental hazards. So what role do you think cases like Bowler v. Early play in all of this? How can we make sure that all communities, no matter who they are protected equally? And how do we ensure that those responsible, that they're held accountable? It's a big question, definitely something to think about as we learn more about how environmental justice and civil rights law, how they intersect.
Yeah, really gets you thinking about the future, doesn't it?
It sure does. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive, everyone. Until next time, keep those legal minds sharp.
See you next time.